Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
Mr. Pop.
Hello and happy President's Day. I'm Royfield Brown, and this is a voice which hopefully, fingers crossed, you'll be hearing a little bit more from in 2023. I have left so many projects up in the air when it comes to 10 American presidents. I've still not done part two of Reagan. I haven't done part two of the election of 1960. And that's just the start of the things which I need to complete. And hopefully, fingers crossed, I will execute on those in the next month or two. Today is a very special recording. Ewan Morgan is a professor in London who has written books on numerous American presidents. And one of them is Ronald Reagan. He spoke to me, goodness, almost 3 years ago now. And that formed the basis of the part one of The Reagan Show a few podcasts ago. I am going to finish that soon, but this is a recording which we did on Zoom. And you can tell by some of the references, this was whilst Donald Trump was still the president of the United States. So this was a couple of years ago. The audience consisted of people on our Facebook group. We also had a Zoom session. And there are a few people there on Zoom, one of them who actually asked a live question. It's a great conversation where Ewan talks about aspects of the life and times of Ronald Reagan so we can fully understand the 40th president. I hope that you enjoy it. It's my present to you for bearing with the podcast. Happy President's Day.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So how many books have you written on American presidents today?
Well, it depends on how you count it, I have written 5 books on American presidents, which I single authored, and about another 12, which I co-edited. In other words, developed a theme for a book, got colleagues in different universities to contribute a chapter to the book, and I edited it, usually in cooperation with a co-editor. quite tough editing books where you'd really do need backup of a co-editor. So, and I've tried not to make myself a specialist for a single president. I think you have to understand the office. You have to understand how different people operated in the office, not different personalities, different times. So I have tried to spread my knowledge of the presidency from Franklin D. Roosevelt through to Donald Trump. And I've even tried my hand very briefly at some 19th century presidents as well.
I must admit, I find those late 19th century presidents an impenetrable puzzle. You know, they all seem to be somewhat kind of featureless. Your Rutherford B. Hayes's, et cetera, et cetera. I kind of quite like the early ones, and then I go to ones in the 20th century. They seem to be much more defined and stuff. So we've established that it was Nixon. It was a love of Nixon, or a fascination with Nixon. A fascination, shall we say.
Let's not call it a love.
A fascination with Richard Nixon, which basically whetted your appetite in terms of a love of American presidents. If we kind of move on to Ronald Reagan, I think one of the things about Reagan is, from the outside, and even from inside of America, many Americans didn't take him seriously. Many Democrats didn't first, because he was seen somewhat of a B-movie actor and somebody who wasn't steeped in politics. And also, he's kind of an affable guy, wasn't he? And I suppose affability can disarm people as to somebody's, you know, it's the strength of their kind of ideology. You've obviously written the book. Tell us one or two things which really surprised you about the formative years of Ronald Reagan politically.
Well, although it was well known that he began life as a Democrat, I was not aware of how utterly committed a liberal Democrat that he was. And he, of course, votes for Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1932, 1936, 1940, and 1944. He believes that Roosevelt has saved the nation in the midst of the Depression, certainly saved his family from his mother and father from falling into destitution. So Ronald Reagan idolizes Franklin D. Roosevelt and remains an admirer, although many Republicans came to disdain Roosevelt as the founder of the of liberal big government, which they tried to demolish when they came to power in the late 20th century, and found that the foundations were resilient to being overthrown. But Ronald Reagan always believed that it had been necessary for Roosevelt to undertake the socioeconomic activism that he promoted in the Great Depression. But he always believed that FDR saw this activism as a temporary necessity to meet the crisis of the Great Depression, and that he would have moved away from it once the Depression was over, and that it was his liberal successors who created the permanent welfare state. I think that that's a misreading of history, but it was a it gave Reagan comfort that his instincts in favor of FDR had been the right one. The second thing, I think, and you alluded to it now, the B-movie actor. In actual fact, he rose very unusually. Not many people succeeded in this. He rose from being a B-movie actor to an A-star. The trouble was that just at the height of his fame, when everything was going wonderfully for him, and he'd appeared in good movies, good directors, good scripts, top production values on the part of the studios, but he then has to go off to war. And even though he does not see active service, nevertheless, for 4 years, he is in uniform. He can't appear in commercial movies. He only appears, because his eyesight is so bad, he cannot be sent overseas to fight. So he becomes a sort of information film maker and performer, an important role helping to boost morale on the home front, helping to sell war bonds and helping pilots with demonstration movies to show what a Japanese Zero looks like if they're in a dogfight with one. So it was an important but not heroic role. But by the time the war ends, Ronald Reagan has come back to Hollywood. The studio don't know what to do with him. Before he went, he was playing the roles of all-American good guys, young guys. But by the time he's back, like many people, he's aged, even though only 5 years, 4 or 5 years has passed. He's taken on the look of a middle-aged man. There's no chance of putting him in the kinds of movies he had before. And because the studio don't know what to do with him, they put him in some real turkeys. And of course, when these turkeys go, they just collapse at the box office, Reagan takes the blame. And he ends up in the B-movies from whence he came. Television saves him. By 1954, Ronald Reagan is a washed-up Hollywood actor who hasn't much of a future. But then he is his agent, who's a very influential man in Hollywood, Lew Wasserman, gets him a long-standing appointment as the host of the General Electric Hour, which airs on Sunday night at 9 o'clock. And that, because...
Let's hold on that, because you've done a lot of history just there. One of the first things you said, what I found quite interesting, utterly fascinating, was that in lots of ways, he, even post him becoming a Republican, he fundamentally understood and agreed with FDR's program, the reasons why it was kind of instituted. For me, one of the interesting things about Reagan is that if I look at the Republican Party today, though Reagan arguably is, there's no arguably about it, is the lion of the Republican Party, every Republican running for high office cites Ronald Reagan as one of the big influences politically on their lives. Is that in many ways, Reagan would be to the left of the modern Republican Party, definitely on something like immigration. And that chimed with me when you talked about, even though by the time of 1964 and him supporting Barry Goldwater, he wants to dismantle this kind of New Deal, Democratic FDR edifice, but that he actually understood the reasons for that. How do you see Reagan's legacy in terms of its interpretation with the modern Republican Party now? And then we'll go back and do a little bit of history.
Okay, well, rather like Margaret Thatcher in Britain, where every conservative has to say that, he's upholding Margaret Thatcher's legacy. In the United States, every Republican has to swear fealty to Ronald Reagan. But, of course, Ronald Reagan was operating in the 1980s, facing a Democratic House of Representatives for 8 years, in the entirety of his presidency, a Democratic Senate for 2 years, and was dealing with a Republican Party that was not the monolithically conservative Republican Party of today. Ronald Reagan realized that he had to be pragmatic. He had to settle for half a loaf. He had to compromise. He never compromised in his rhetoric. His rhetoric always projected this conservative idealism, conservative vision. But to get things done, as he discovered when governor of California, you couldn't be Simon Pure in your ideology and say you weren't going to bend in order to get most of what you wanted. And Reagan, I've always regarded Reagan as a pragmatic conservative. and also someone who saw himself as president of all Americans, not simply the ones who voted for him. And I don't think that Ronald Reagan played base mobilization politics in the way that, let's say, George W. Bush did, and of course, most notably, Donald Trump. So I think Reagan would have been uncomfortable in today's politics. You know, he gave as good as he got. He got into verbal fights with the House Speaker, the House Democratic Speaker, Tip O'Neill. But at the same time, he was prepared to socialize with O'Neill, would have him around to the White House for drinks. And he always said, from 9 to 6 in the day, we were sworn enemies. But, after 6 o'clock, you've got to recognize he's got his beliefs, I've got mine, and we've got to try and live together. So I don't think Reagan would have been a natural at the kind of politics we have in the United States today, the politics of anger, the politics of polarization, the politics of division. Ronald Reagan was a unifier. And of course, he realized that the Republicans were a minority party. The Democrats were in decline, but they still clung on to a congressional majority. So Ronald Reagan knew that he had to win habitual Democratic voters to his side. You couldn't do that by saying what a terrible group of people Democrats were, that you had to reach out to them. Mm-hmm. He failed with certain groups. He always said that one of his greatest disappointments was his failure to connect with African Americans. But he connected pretty well with Hispanic Americans, winning a pretty large share of their vote in 1984, 40%, which is pretty high for a Republican. And, of course, as you pointed out, he sees America as the promised land, and he wants to open its doors to the immigrants who can get there. Reagan doesn't want to build a wall, doesn't want to build walls, and... he famously says in his farewell address, the city on the hill is here to, it's a city for everybody who has the will and the courage to get here.
It's one interesting to compare and contrast, and you can't help but do that, with the current incumbent of the White House. But specifically, let's look at one of the things which you just said there, which is that Reagan was pro-immigration. And saw America as a beacon, as opposed to this now Trumpian Republican Party, which is very much isolationist. And also wanting to reach out to Americans of all colors and stripes. Why specifically do you think that Reagan didn't have success with African American voters? Obviously, there's a history since FDR. Well, first off, historically, because of emancipation, African Americans used to be overwhelmingly Republican because it was the party of emancipation. That starts to break down and change with FDR, doesn't it? And the New Deal. Yeah. And then you have civil rights legislation in the 50s and specifically really the 60s. That's when it really, really hits. And that's under Johnson. But still by, let's say, the 1970s, though black Republican voters are going to be in the minority, there still were a few. So why is it that Reagan, do you think, couldn't reach out to African American voters, considering that he had a landslide in 1984? He took all states apart from one. So Latino Americans, as you said, 40%. White Americans, obviously the overwhelming majority. What was it about African Americans and Reagan not being able to connect with them, do you think?
Well, partly, of course, is that Reagan is seeking to roll back the liberal state, which African Americans see as essential for their well-being. In trying to dismantle elements of the New Deal and more particularly of the Great Society, He says, you know, I'm trying to free people from the dead hand of government. But to African Americans, that benevolent state was essential to assist them cope with the economic problems that they experienced. You know, the factory gates have been thrown open to them. But at the very time that the number of factories are in decline, or the good jobs beginning to go in the 1970s, so that these poverty programs of the national government, the social welfare programs, are seen as essential. And what's interesting is that Reagan always said, look, the black middle class is growing. What's the problem? This is an American success story. If you go back to the 1980s, Michael Jackson, mega pop star, across racial groupings, the most popular television show of the decade was the Cosby Show. And Reagan was always saying, well, you know, we're part of the African Americans have been part of the mainstream. And the African-American middle class was certainly growing. But what was interesting was the sense of racial solidarity that the people who had made it resented Reagan for trying to pull the ladder up to prevent the bottom two-fifths of African-Americans from to bring them up to a decent standard of living. I don't think Reagan was a racist. I would, I've had this argument with the cohorts of students who say, well, if he wasn't a racist, why did he do things that were potentially harmful to African-Americans by trying to take away programs that benefited them? Why did he not willingly sign the legislation early on that made Martin Luther King's birthday a national holiday? And why did he resist the effort to impose economic sanctions against the apartheid regime in South Africa? You know, this catalogue of issues. But you know, we have to come back to Ronald Reagan's concept of freedom. It's a concept of freedom from the state rather than the concept of the freedom of economic security that was the New Deal's definition of freedom. So for Reagan, the government, as he said in his 1981 inaugural, government is not the solution to a problem, government is the problem. You believe people have become too dependent on government, and that the freedom that he saw himself as bringing was the freedom for individuals to maximize their talent, maximize their wealth. And he believed in equality of opportunity, but not in affirmative action. He said, you know, you can't try to favor one group. Equality of opportunity, no artificial barriers, but you then can't use government to try to promote the interests of any particular group. A lot of people said, well, why did he promote the interests of the rich with your tax cuts? But for Ronald Reagan, that was really freeing up the rich to make more money so that they could invest, create more jobs, and so on. Mm. It's a conservative view of freedom, whereas FDR had offered a liberal view of freedom, that the central state would guarantee Americans a basic level of economic security so that they did not have to go through life on minimum wages and have poverty in their old age. So it's too freedom is the defining word of the American experience, that it means different things to different people. And of course, freedom became something that an important word to African Americans, the freedom struggle of the 1960s. But it was a different concept of freedom, this word that kept on being used by different groups for different purposes. And Ronald Reagan, by the same token that Reagan's critics didn't understand his view of it, he didn't understand theirs.
Interesting. Let's go back to the 1950s and then let's end back in the 1980s, and then maybe we can then project forward. In the 1950s, depending on who you believe, this is these are halcyon days of American global might, economic strength, etc. Yes, it's the Cold War, and America has its existential enemy, the Soviet Union. But if you look at the American movies at the time, there, you know, it's movies of new suburbia, of new consumer goods. We have a president, Eisenhower, who is a Republican, but in many ways is a continuation of FDR and FDR's legacy. Now, the interstate program, that's massive government spending by anybody's reckoning. And he's very much, and then we have the first tangible, real steps of desegregation, Brown versus Brown, etc. In the 1950s. But that is the point where the Federalist Society is founded, and then also ideologically has this kind of counter vision. When we talked, you talked about Reagan reading, you know, these new political and economic philosophies. How much you talked about him being a pragmatist by the time he actually comes into power. How much of his legislative program would you say is driven utterly by that ideology that he, you know, takes hold of in the 1950s? How much of it is pragmatism? Then how much of this is, let's say, the exhaustion of FDR's New Deal program by the time we get to the 1980s? That, you know, that, you know what, this safety net for all Americans, you know, it had to go, etc. So how much of this is, how much of Reagan's time in power is ideology? How much of is this just a 30, 40 years after FDR, things need to change, should change, etc., etc.? How ideologically driven actually was he?
Well, of course, we have to see Ronald Reagan in broad terms. Ronald Reagan did not suddenly emerge in 1980 and bring conservatism to America. Conservatism was a movement that had been growing steadily since the 1950s, and a sense that big government wasn't working, that America wasn't flexing its muscles sufficiently, that it was in danger of losing the Cold War. So all of these things bubble up, and Barry Goldwater is the first manifestation of that. Now, Goldwater frightened Americans because he was seen as such a zealot that he'd roll back Social Security, that he would engage in a nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union. And that catastrophic defeat for Goldwater in 1964 is very important to Ronald Reagan, because he, of course, was a fervent Goldwaterite, had spoken to him in a national television broadcast and actually done a much better job than the candidate himself in putting over the conservative message. But Ronald Reagan said, we cannot do this again. You know, we can't frighten people. We've got to sell our message as a positive one, not frighten people, to show what the possibilities of conservatism are. So he realizes that in American politics at that time, that you couldn't be an out-and-out ideologue. You had to recognize that it would take time for people to come to you. And what you had to do was find issues which were important in bringing new people along. And for Ronald Reagan, the most important of these issues was taxation. Okay, now, what's interesting is that in the 1930s, a new Democratic Party emerges. Sorry, this is a bit of a history lesson. Up in the 1930s, from the Civil War to the 1930s, the Democratic Party was predominantly a white Protestant Southern party. FDR and the New Deal bring a working class, an urban ethnic working class, or, you know, the bottom half of the income distribution into the party. Now, what's interesting about this is that the New Deal is giving these new groups programs to help them gain economic security, to help them advance, keep them in work, but they're not paying for these programs because the tax base until World War II was very, very narrow. People paid taxes on consumption, but they did not, only about 5% of American families paid income tax in 1940. It was an elite tax, not a mass tax. This changes with the Second World War because a new tax system is created that brings almost everybody, 80% of Americans within its remit. And that tax system is sustained to pay for the Cold War, pays for the First World War and Second World War, but in every other American war, war taxes are removed once war ends. These taxes are continued to pay for the Cold War. And what's happening, that as America is becoming more prosperous, white working class and lower middle class Americans now find they have to pay taxes. And they say, why? And they don't think it's defend America in the Cold War. It's to bring African Americans. So they're saying our tax dollars that we work hard for are going to, you know, people who aren't willing to work hard, you know. The racial prejudice of the times, we don't have to go into, but Ronald Reagan picks up on this and he recognizes that tax is an issue that is no longer something that appeals to the rich. It appeals to the middle classes and the upper echelons of the white working class. And if he can create a coalition in support of lower taxes, and the corollary of lower taxes is smaller government, that is the way forward.
So in terms of an overwhelming drive to cut taxes, as you said, the corollary of that is kind of smaller government. I've always been a little bit mystified by Republicans, conservatives, specifically talking about a lessening of the state. But when it comes to the military, absolutely is complete and utter the opposite. And obviously the military is very much kind of part of the state apparatus. And actually, it's interesting when you look at American history, and it's Eisenhower who warns of the military industrial complex, and he's a general, you know, he was a general. Could you explain Reagan's relationship with the military? It appears to me, a humble Brit who grew up in the 1980s, that he was very much, Ronald Reagan very much became America, and he felt very much like the commander in chief. But kind of explain that, and then other totems of America and Americana.
Okay, well. Ronald Reagan becomes president at a time, of course, just following the Vietnam War. And what's happened is that during the early Cold War, the United States has built up this massive defense establishment, massive in all ways, conventional and nuclear. But the unpopularity of the Vietnam War and the failure of the United States to win that war brings about a reconsideration of the Cold War military and its purpose. And you have, whereas there's been a Cold War consensus up until Vietnam, Vietnam fragments it, and you have liberals saying, look, our goals ought to be peace, human rights, and economic development on a global basis, not armed camps facing each other, leading to potential accidental nuclear war. Now, Ronald Reagan always said that even though détente, of course, was initiated by Republican Richard Nixon, he always said that détente missed the fundamental point of the Cold War. The Cold War was not a struggle between two superpowers. It was a struggle between two value systems. And that you could not have détente between clearly contradictory values of democracy and communism. And for him, he believed that the Soviets had used the period of détente to build up their military power to a point of equality with the United States, that the United States had lessened its military spending, so that by 1980, he was issuing the warning that the United States was in danger of losing the Cold War. Late December 1979, of course, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan is seen as a new signal of Soviet assertion. It's the first time that the Soviets have intervened outside Eastern Europe. So, you know, what's happening here? They're trying to drive down through Afghanistan in towards the Persian Gulf and threaten Western oil supplies, etc. So what Ronald Reagan said, the only way we can have peace with the Soviet Union is through being stronger. So what Reagan says is we must spend massively on defense. The détente is no way of achieving peace. We'll have some relaxation of tensions, and then we'll be back into a situation of confrontation. The only way to solve the problem of communism is to demonstrate that we are stronger than it. And that means massive expenditure on armaments of all kinds. And of course, in 1983, Reagan's own fears about nuclear war lead him to this idea we can't simply rely on deterrence, balance of offensive weaponry. Why don't we build a space, a defense shield in space that will take out incoming nuclear missiles? Of course, this revolutionizes the whole concept of military deterrence. And the Soviet Union's leaders are genuinely frightened that they know the Soviet Union is an economic basket case, can't compete technologically with the United States for much longer. 40% of the Soviet GDP is going on defense compared to 5% of the American GDP. Reagan says, look, we're going to win any arms race because they're running as fast as they can right now. They can't go any faster and we're just walking. And, so Ronald Reagan sets out to peace through strength, build your position up to a position of superiority. But he does believe in the other side of the equation, peace. He doesn't want to obliterate communism in the Soviet Union. He does want to free Eastern Europe from communism. He says, if the Soviet people want communism, they can have it, but they can't implant it anywhere else. You know. So,
Ewan, here's a question for you. I remember at the time, when Star Wars was first muted, that Reagan said, we'll share the technology with the Russians. Is that going to underline what you've just said there? Or was he being disingenuous when he said that? Because it makes sense in hindsight that this is just an extra turn of the screw economically on the Russians, that they don't have the technological wherewithal to do this. But I remember at the time, at first, when he says, right, we're going to, you know, Star Wars, we're going to have this defense shield in space. But he did say he'd share it with the Russians.
He did. And the Russians, of course, didn't believe him. But he was serious about it. It would take many years. It still hasn't been developed yet. course, this shield in space. Ronald Reagan hated communism, but he also feared nuclear war. He said, you know, why are the Russians so frightened of us? What have they got? They have nothing that we want. But if they're frightened of us, they could be, they might launch a nuclear attack in the belief that we are going to attack them and we have no intention of doing so. So he thought accidental nuclear war was a real possibility. He wanted to reduce the level of nuclear weaponry, but he needed somebody in the Soviet Union as a leader who would recognize that reducing nuclear weapons would not only improve the prospects of peace, but would also improve the prospects of the Soviet Union being able to divert money from defense into much needed renewal of their economy. So Ronald Reagan was lucky that Mikhail Gorbachev comes along when he does. But Mikhail Gorbachev, I always think Gorbachev gets a wonderful press from the Western left and the Western liberal media, and that Ronald Reagan is seen as somebody who, you know, wasn't quite up to him as a world statesman. Well, Ronald Reagan was certainly up to Gorbachev as a world statesman. Ronald Reagan took many risks to get that nuclear deal with Gorbachev, the INF Treaty of 1987. He alienated many of his supporters on the right. And he said, you know, this is the right thing to do. And he followed through on that. And Gorbachev, who initially saw Reagan as somebody who couldn't be trusted, eventually comes to trust him a great deal.
We have a question on Facebook. It's from the 10 American Presidents Facebook group. It's from Steve Tortellini. Does your guest have any opinion about any of the plethora of Reagan documentaries that are out there? I tend to learn a lot from the movies I watch. I saw one of them by Jarecki in 2011 at the Sundance Festival. Any take on that one in particular? I don't know if you know that movie. Ewan.
I don't know that, but of course 2011 was Ronald Reagan's centenary, born in 1911. So the movies came out about him. I think what is interesting about Reagan, how he has been embraced. We talked earlier about how he was an icon for the American right. Well, in 2011, his centenary was celebrated by Democrats as much as by Republicans, and the Democrats at the time, different to the kind of Tea Party and conservative Republican that they were dealing with during the Obama presidency. You know, Ronald Reagan is like FDR and virtually any president, he can be used to promote a particular message at different times. So he is an icon of the right. But I think a lot of filmmakers have seen in Reagan a very valuable subject for study because he is such a complex figure.
And as a compare and contrast as one Brit to another, he's, as we've said, very much an icon of the right, in the way that Margaret Thatcher is in the UK, maybe slightly less so. But when she passed, the fact that she had an almost state funeral was seen as incredibly divisive in the United Kingdom, wasn't it?
Yes, a state funeral. How many times has it been accorded in recent times? I can only think of Winston Churchill, who had a truly state funeral. Of course, the President of the United States is somewhat different in terms of status. President of the United States is head of state and head of government. Prime Minister is only head of government. So in a sense, Margaret Thatcher, of course, was a much more divisive figure than Ronald Reagan. What we have to keep in mind, of course, is that although Margaret Thatcher's Conservative Party won massive majorities in 1983 and 1987, her support, voter support, was about 43-44% of voters. Ronald Reagan's voter support was for in his presidential elections, both in 1980 and 1984, he had much greater support, winning a landslide in 1984, both in the Electoral College and in the popular vote. So Reagan has more cross-party appeal. Because he is so good at projecting patriotism and projecting an optimistic view of America, I think if you don't recognize those two things about Reagan, you miss something very important. And that vision had immense attraction for Americans at the time. I don't think Margaret Thatcher quite had, but she didn't have that. She had the sense of patriotism, but she could not project the same sense of consensual optimism as Ronald Reagan did.
Mm. Interesting. They were very much seen as two peas ideologically in a pod during the 1980s. I was going to ask the question, which is, you know, who was led by the other? But I think we've kind of answered that, and Reagan's conservatism goes back to the 1950s. Let's go to 1964. So he gives that speech, which is televised. It's an event for Barry Goldwater. Does he really leap from being a kind of washed up actor to being a conservative champion literally overnight? Because then he does then become the governor of California. When we spoke, I think you said that he didn't have, he wasn't really looking for political office until that point. Was that true? Am I misremembering? Does he go from washed up B-movie actor that, you know, on the GE Electric, shows to, wow, Barry Goldwater, he didn't work, but maybe this guy could work. Was it literally was that speech as important as that in terms of creating Ronald Reagan, who then become the president?
Yes, I think it's very difficult to understate or to overestimate the importance of that that speech. Conservatives lacked an appealing leader. Mm. Barry Goldwater was angry and divisive. You think of conservatives in the United States, you think of angry figures like Joseph McCarthy or staunch anti-communists like the Burke Society, who have an element of, conspiracy element to them, kooks. Ronald Reagan is the first conservative who can speak to the American people, explain the conservative vision in positive terms and not frighten them. Now, his rise was not overnight. I think that he had been, when he begins on the GE circuit, you know, it's he's a glad hander. He's going around the country on a morale boosting trips for GE workers. But by the third year of his contract, you know, he's beginning to think more and more, and his speeches are becoming more political. And the GE is a critical to his ideological emergence, because GE then begins to use him on the conservative political circuit, because GE wants to put across the message, you know, we want less government, less taxes, less regulation, and a bigger military. This is what Ronald Reagan is saying, and this is in GE's corporate interest. The Republicans begin to recognize Reagan as somebody who can put their message across. And in 1960, of course, Richard Nixon asks Ronald Reagan to make speeches for him when he's running against John Kennedy. And Reagan said, gladly, oh, by the way, I'm still a registered Democrat. I'll register as a Republican. And Nixon says, no, I want you to stay as a Democrat, because you're much more potent speaking as a Democrat against Kennedy than if you were a Republican. But it takes about 8 years more accurately, from about 1957 through to 1964, for Ronald Reagan to build up on that stage to national prominence. And it happens in 1964. So the Republicans are now looking around, well, we've been crushed. Do we go back to being a moderate party, or do we keep the conservative flame alive? And a lot of people wanted to keep the conservative flame alive if they could find somebody to deliver the message in an appealing manner. And Ronald Reagan was friendly with a group of California businessmen. And California, of course, had a gubernatorial election in 1966, 2 years after the presidential debacle. And they began to work on Ronald Reagan to get him to run for governor. And eventually he gives in. He doesn't want to do it. He said, I am an actor who enjoys giving speeches. But slowly but surely, his resistance is worn down. And of course, he is a natural on the campaign trail. He does need a lot of coaching. You know, it's not quite like acting, but as Ronald Reagan himself once said, I don't think anybody could rise to the presidency without having been an actor. You know, you really do need that kind of capacity to put things over and appear sincere. I think sincerity was very important in Ronald Reagan's image. When Ronald Reagan runs for California governor in 1966, California has just become the most populous state in the union of 50 states. It is the jewel. If the Republicans can take California, they're on their way back. And Ronald Reagan becomes the spearhead of that Republican renewal. It still takes him another 14 years to rise to the presidency, because the party is still worried about that Goldwater debacle. Can we risk going with a Republican right winger again as our standard bearer? Richard Nixon becomes the 1968 and 72 standard bearer. Reagan and Ford go head to head in 1976, but the Republicans just aren't ready for Reagan yet. Reagan nearly snatches the nomination from the incumbent president, but there's still this residue of suspicion. We can't win with the right winger. But by 1980, Ronald Reagan's got the message. Everything he said has seemingly come true. Big government can't create prosperity. The United States is in the grip of the worst economic crisis since the 1930s. The United States seems to be losing the Cold War under the guise of detente, and Americans have lost their natural optimism. They have become a pessimistic nation, poll after poll showing that something like well over half of Americans believe the present is worse than the past, and the future will be even worse than the present. You know, this is pessimism that is not part of this optimistic nation. And that pessimism, of course, I think the parallel between Reagan and Trump. Reagan understood that pessimism, and Trump understood it.
It's just a last shout out to everybody who's watching on the various different medium. We are on Facebook. I'm going to try and log on to Facebook. If you see me looking away when Ewan is talking, it's because I'm looking at the various different feeds. If you do have a question, post it on whatever feed you're looking at, and I will try and get that over to you. And but you got to bear with me. I'm looking at on my phone. I'm going from screen to screen. Deborah, you're watching on Zoom. So if you have a question after I ask my next one, unmute your microphone and you can ask your question, Deborah.
Hello, I'm here.
Deborah, okay. Well, why don't you go now? Why don't you ask your question? Go for it.
I was just wondering what your guest's comments might be on the power and influence of Nancy Reagan over President Reagan.
Nancy, Yes, very interesting. A woman who had an unfairly bad press, in my opinion. I think Nancy Reagan was very, very important to her husband. I think he came to have an emotional dependence on her. Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan's relationship with Nancy, I think that, you know, he wasn't sure at the beginning whether this was the woman of his dreams, but shortly after they got married, I think he became deeply and absolutely head over heels in love with her. And, you know, you've only got to look at his diary, which he writes in the presidential years. And at one point, Nancy has gone to London to represent Ronald Reagan at the marriage of Prince Charles and Lady Diana. Ronald Reagan can't go because he's still recuperating from the assassination attempt. And he writes in his diary, "Nancy is going to be away for 6 days. I don't know how I can stand it. I can't stand being away from her for one day, let alone six." And, you know, the diary is full of these references to Nancy. Now, a lot of people have said, well, Nancy was a malign influence on Ronald Reagan. She was a hardball conservative. Her stepfather was one of the most conservative of Goldwater backers. And Nancy was, you know, a right-winger par excellence. Nothing could be further from the truth. Nancy Reagan wasn't interested in politics. She was interested in Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan was her project. And if Ronald Reagan wanted to be president of the United States, she was going to help him become president. And she did. She was very good at telling him what worked, what didn't. Ronald Reagan was a real softy. Okay, he couldn't fire anybody, regardless of how incompetent they were. Nancy Reagan was prepared to be the hard cop, the bad cop. Ronald Reagan's nice cop. In 1980, she did something very important for Ronald Reagan. She got his campaign manager sacked, who was fighting the wrong strategy on the campaign and very nearly lost the nomination race for Ronald Reagan. But she wanted her husband to be remembered as a great president. And she thought the way that he would best be remembered as a great president was as a man of peace. And she was an early advocate of negotiations with the Soviet Union and reducing world tensions. I don't think Ronald Reagan was converted by her, but certainly her willingness to push that message to him and to support members of his administration like George Shultz, who was something of a dove against the hawkish voices or people like Caspar Weinberger. So in the palace politics of the Reagan White House, you know, she was definitely on the side of those who wanted Ronald Reagan to negotiate with the Soviets. So I would say she is a very important figure. I'm just trying to make a comparison. I think that there have been three very important first ladies in the last 50 years. Michelle Obama, obviously, Hillary Clinton, but I would put Nancy Reagan up there as equally significant in terms of their husband's administration.
Mrs. Roosevelt as well.
Of course, she was almost 100 years ago. No, if Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, is the gold standard, but there'll never be another Eleanor Roosevelt, I don't think, because FDR allowed her to campaign independently on the issues that interested her. He felt he owed her in view of the fact that, he'd come close to destroying their marriage in the during the second decade of the 20th century through his adultery. So he felt he owed Eleanor Roosevelt something, and Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, emerges from FDR's shadow to be a real force in American politics in her own right. I don't think any first lady has been able to do that since then. They've been appendages to their husbands rather than independent forces in their own right.
Great question there, Deborah. Got another question from Facebook, Ewan. This is from Adam Vanami. Says, ask him his opinion. And it says, if he agrees that Reagan lost his faculties whilst in office, at what point was he past the line of being functional in office, and how much did he lean on Nancy? So this kind of carries on from Deborah's question about the importance of Nancy towards the end of his time in office. But I think all historians agree, don't they, that towards the end of his time in office, the signs of dementia were there. How bad was it, in your opinion? And then how much did he lean on his wife?
This is a question that has not fully been resolved as yet. Look, I've read Ronald Reagan's papers, I've read oral histories, and very importantly, I've read his diary. And I can't see somebody who's capable of functioning like that as being seriously in the grip of dementia. We've got to remember that Ronald Reagan was nearly killed by an assassination attempt in April 1981. And he bounces back pretty quickly from that. But, you know, he's been seriously wounded. It could have gone either way. So I think that that has an effect on him as well. He's a 70-year-old man who has been the victim of a serious gunshot wound. But coming back to your question, look, this is a guy who negotiated with Mikhail Gorbachev, sometimes on a one-to-one basis, sometimes in a room full of other people. And only once does he really flop in his negotiations with Gorbachev, where he goes off the point, where he tries to tell funny stories. But every other time he's focused. This is true of Moscow in 1988, Washington in 1987, Reykjavik in 1986, and Geneva in 1985. So, you know, my concern is that if this guy was in the grip of some kind of dementia, how come was he so good? How come, you know, in 1987, he takes on the conservative wing of his own party to force through the ratification of the INF Treaty? How come he decides he can trust Gorbachev to take the two countries forward towards peace? I think Ronald Reagan declined very quickly after leaving the presidency. And one of the reasons he declined in 1990, he's on a vacation in Mexico at a friend's ranch with Nancy, and he's riding in the hills with a couple of other people, and his Ronald Reagan is, of course, an excellent horseman, but something spooks his horse. The horse backs up and throws Reagan, who lands on his head, and I think that set off the dementia, accelerated it. From that point on, Ronald Reagan is on a steep downward slope. And it's then he becomes dependent on Nancy. From the time that dementia takes hold in the post-presidential years to the time that he writes the open letter to the American people to say that he's on this journey to oblivion, And of course, Nancy becomes a protector of the Reagan legacy and the Reagan reputation in the years when her husband is effectively bedridden and seriously out of things. But, you know, Nancy Reagan was balanced in what she did. One of my favorite stories about her is that I think it was in 1999 that some Republicans decided it would be a great idea if Ronald Reagan's head appeared on the dime coin in place of Franklin D. Roosevelt's. And Nancy Reagan rubbishes it. No, we're not having that. Ronnie would not have let that happen, and I'm not going to let it happen.
I think, Ewan, we're just about at the end. Thank you to everybody who's been watching. I'm looking at the phone there, who's watching on the 10 American Presidents stream on Facebook, and also on the Just History stream, also on Facebook, and then also on YouTube. But I think we should, unless you've got another question, Deborah.
I have one trivia question. Who is Ronald Reagan's best man?
Who is Ronald Reagan's best man? Well, I do know who was the best man for his second wedding, and that was William Holden.
Correct. Thank you. I don't know the first. I was thinking of William Holden as well.
He and William Holden became great friends, and it was always a great regret for Ronald Reagan that William Holden became addicted to alcohol and... of course, he died as a result of an accident during the early years of the Reagan presidency when he fell down and hit his head. He fell down because he was drunk, hit his head, and died of that. But Holden and Reagan were allies in the anti-communist politics of the Hollywood Red Scare of the late 1940s. I'm trying to think of who Ronald Reagan's best man was in his first wedding, but I can tell you this, that it was held in the home of Luella Parsons, who came from almost the same a small Illinois town as Ronald Reagan. What a coincidence. The greatest Hollywood gossip columnist is somebody who comes from the small town Midwest. And she made a big effort to promote Reagan's career when he was just making the step up from being a B-movie actor to an A star.
Well done. You know your stuff. That's the reason why you've written a book, and you just proved it. You've written a book on the man. Pull out that level of detail. Deborah, thank you for that supplemental question. And again, thank you to everybody who's been watching on the various different streams. If you're listening to this, and most people will end up listening to this and not watching it, very obviously, this is a supplemental episode of 10 American Presidents. You would have heard part one and part two of the life of Ronald Reagan, and this, it was just a great way for listeners to get to ask Ewan Morgan, the author of the book Reagan, American Icon, to basically fill in a little bit of the gaps, maybe things which I didn't ask him in the two shows on the life of Ronald Reagan. If you are watching on Facebook and you're like, what the hell is going on here? I was just minding my own business, having a little bit of Facebook action. And all of a sudden, there is this feed. I produce a thing called 10 American Presidents. I've fallen in love with American politics and American presidential history. And this is my ode to it by doing 10 American Presidents. So there is a podcast. It's available at all the regular places, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, etc., etc. Please go listen to it. It isn't just the 10 pivotal American presidencies. We do look at other things like the history of impeachment, presidential speech, etc., etc. But at its core, it's an in-depth dive and audio documentaries about America's 10 pivotal presidencies, which is a hard thing to say. Pivotal presidencies, if you're not careful. Ewan, We did say this, I think, just before we hit record. But why don't you tell people about your other presidential books and what you're working on at the moment?
Yes, thanks. The first presidential book I wrote was about Dwight D. Eisenhower and his struggle to balance the federal budget. I then wrote a very short biography of Richard Nixon. That was back in 2000. I've written about various aspects of the American presidency thereafter. That's my first love. My second love is Hollywood cinema. And I did a book in 2011 called Presidents in the Movies, examining biopics or representations of American presidents in films. And I did a comparison for my contribution. Other people contributed to the book, and I contributed a chapter comparing the 1993 movie Nixon with the 1942 movie Tennessee Johnson. And I wanted to show how American movies had represented two presidents who had been impeached or had undergone an impeachment process. Richard Nixon, of course, wasn't impeached, but resigned to avoid that fate. Then I did the Reagan book, and because I've never written a big book about a Democrat, I felt it was time to balance that out. And I'm in the final stages of the manuscript on the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Brilliant. And then how can people catch up with you on social media if they're into Twitter and all those modern things there, Ewan?
I really should start living in the 21st century, but I'm still a 20th century man. I do have a Twitter account, but it's been dormant for some time, and I'm afraid that I have stopped my TV appearances because I'm always being asked who's going to win the 2020 presidential election, and I'm in the dark as much as anybody else.
Listen, if you get asked, right, and you don't know, give them my email address. I'll go on NBC, etc., and I'll tell them who's going to win, right? But that's and I'll be proved right when I tell everybody who I think is going to win on November the 4th, who I thought was going to win on November the 4th. But Ewan Morgan, thank you for coming on to 10 American Presidents. Thank you, Deborah, for your great question and for following us on Zoom. Thank you for Steve Tortellini and Adam Bonami, who asked questions on Facebook. Thank you for the people who've been watching this on YouTube. The podcast is 10 American Presidents. We still have part two of The Life of Ronald Reagan, which should hopefully be with you before Christmas. These things do take me a long time to produce. Dare I say it, the easy bit is just being here with the expert, with somebody like Ewan, who can just wax lyrical for, I think we did 2.5 hours worth of audio of just Ewan talking about Ronald Reagan. Then I have to then find the audio clips, and that does take me some time. So bear with me. Hopefully you've had a great time with Ewan, filling in some of the details on the life of America's 40th president. Take care, look after yourself, be good. Bye-bye.